at Concordia River Forest, Illinois, which is also his alma mater. He holds advanced degrees from the Eastman School of Music and from this seminary, and has been granted honorary doctorates from two of our synodical schools. He will be honored tomorrow by Concordia Historical Institute for his recent work in the field of American Lutheran hymnody. And if you haven't seen these two books which have been published in the past 2 years, God's Song in a New Land, Lutheran Hymnals in America, and its companion volume, Source Documents in American Lutheran Hymnody. And if you would, please give me a moment, I'll read Dr. Brower's review of this book, at least a portion of it, in the latest Concordia Journal. Dr. Schalk provides an analysis of American Lutheranism's hymnals and points to a key contribution of the LVW-LW project, namely the inclusion of the core Lutheran hymns. While these hymns may be rejected by many who seek cultural relevance in the contemporary setting and who substitute hymnody with simple tune and unpretentious text upon which anyone may project a personal belief system, the core Lutheran hymns do remain essential. If they are taught, they can become a cornerstone of the song which builds faith by the gospel and its application to life. Even when they are not used, they provide a model of how the clear doctrine can become a part of the people's song. Dr. Schalk recounts the American story of preserving this song in a new land, song that reveals a trust in the power of the gospel proclamation. This book deserves the attention of scholars, musicians, and most of all, pastors. It is our honor this evening to welcome Dr. Carl Schalk.
Thank you, Ben. The one part he didn't read to you from that review was the way it began, which said something like, Carl Schalk has been looking at and studying and writing about hymnals for 30 years. And then he didn't quite say it, and it's time to be quiet about them now for a while. But nevertheless, that's very, very kind. I'm pleased to be here, and I'm absolutely amazed that so many people are out here on this otherwise dismal night. And what I'd like to do is to talk for maybe about a half an hour or thereabouts. It usually goes a little longer than that, and then open this up for questions, because I think you may well have some. Lutheran Hymnals in America and the Next Lutheran Hymnal. I thought that was a snappy title. You probably know as much as I do about the Next Lutheran Hymnal, but I have some ideas. But let's look a little bit at the first part of that topic. Of the three books which have shaped Lutheran piety since its origins in the 16th century, those three books being the Bible, the Catechism, and the Hymnal, one might reasonably argue that it's the Hymnal, the one which is most regularly and frequently encountered by most people, I think, which has had the most enduring and lasting influence on the popular piety of Lutherans. At least I think one could argue that. It is the regular and recurrent use of hymns in worship that has shaped so much of our vocabulary of words, phrases, and images that have become part of our collective and individual memory as church. Hymns implanted in our memory and recalled to mind in the various situations of the Christian life are more powerful and influential in our spiritual nurture than we are often ready to admit. But it would be my thesis that the succession of hymnals from that first little collection of eight hymns in 1524 down to the very most recent one in 1993, Christian Worship, a Lutheran hymnal of the Wisconsin Synod, that whole succession of hymns, simply as hymnals, cannot simply be regarded as the arbitrary or capricious result of the work of various individuals who are motivated largely by a spirit of aimless innovation. Rather, my thesis is that the changing shape of Lutheran hymnody, at least as reflected in its successive hymnals, has been the result rather of the intellectual and religious ferment of each age which gave it birth. And it was accepted or rejected precisely because it was in harmony with the spirit of its own time. This was certainly the case, I think, with Lutheran hymnody in America, as it is reflected in the various hymn books which have helped to shape the piety of American Lutherans. Now, just a little side note here. When we talk about Lutherans coming to America, we usually historically begin with the Swedes on the Delaware and the Dutch in Amsterdam and so on. But I would point out to you that probably the first group that was in North America to sing Lutheran chorales were probably the Danes in 1619, when as part of the Jens Munk expedition, which came from Denmark and settled for a brief time on the western shores of Hudson Bay. We know they had a priest with them. We know the books that they were using in Denmark at the time, their liturgies, liturgical books, and their hymnals. And it's very likely that the very first Lutheran chorales to be sung in North America were sung by the Danes on that western shore of Hudson Bay in 1619. Now, just think of that. 1619 was less than 75 years from the publication of the Babst Gesangbuch in 1545, which is generally considered to be the most representative hymnal of at the mid-16th century. It was the last book for which Luther had written a preface. Now, this is 74 years, I think that is, if my mathematics is right. 74 years after that time, here are Lutherans singing some kind of song, probably some of those chorales that had made their way to the Scandinavian countries, singing them on the west shore of Hudson Bay. Now, that was an unfortunately very short-lived expedition, and a few of them managed to scramble back to their home in Denmark. The rest of them died in that place. But I think it's just interesting to see how quickly that happened. But the most significant and largest group of Lutherans then began to come to America in the early 1700s and are part of the whole movement centered around the person and the work of Henry Melchior Muhlenberg. And when one talks about Muhlenberg, one remembers that he was the person who made the first Made in America Lutheran hymnal, the Erbauliche Liedersammlung of 1786. There were other books that were being used that they had brought with them from their homelands and that they had found from other places, but this was the first Lutheran hymn book made in America by Muhlenberg, 1786. Now that still is fairly, not too far removed from the Reformation time. But now, one of the concerns that you see in every one of the groups, it begins with Muhlenberg, you see it in the Prussians and the Saxons when they come over in the next century, almost every group that comes over is confronted with one problem, one obvious problem, and that was this, that they all brought with them the hymnals from their homeland. And so when you got a group of Lutherans together, they were all had different books. And that made worshiping together or singing together problematic because you couldn't say, well, it's number 27 in this hymn book and 86 in that one and 28. It was a problem. And so from the very beginning, and I would just read this one little quote from Muhlenberg, there was a desire expressed that there be one book, one hymnal that all Lutherans in America could share. These are Muhlenberg's words. He says, it should be noted what until now has hindered a complete unity in connection with singing in our public worship, namely the many kinds of hymn books, since in almost every one various little alterations have been made, and in some of which there are few hymns, in others many. And then this is the part. If only there were one hymn book for all the American Lutheran congregations which would contain the best of the old and new spiritual songs, how much more convenient it would be. I would argue that you can look at the whole history of Lutheran hymnals and hymnody in America through the prism of that idea of the search for a one book which would serve all Lutherans in America and the rise and fall of that idea because it both rose and it fell. And I'd like to just say a couple of things about that. For those who, starting with Muhlenberg, for those who came to this country and were seeking to pursue that vision of a common book, there were a number of problems. I would mention three. The first problem was the problem of language, a problem which ultimately resulted in the development of two separate strands of hymnody, one in the language of the homeland and then the other in the language of the new country, in English. So you had German hymnody, English hymnody. You had Norwegian hymnody, later English hymnody. There were two kind of parallel tracks. One for those groups which chose to retain the language and culture of their homeland, the other for those who turned rather immediately to English. The difference was not only cultural, it was at least perceived to be theological as well. For the difference was between those, in Edwin Scott Gausted's words, those who on, quote, on the one hand would boldly adopt English in order to win America, and those who on the other hand feared to embrace English lest they be lost in America. And in that kind of a description, you see some of the same cultural questions that are being raised in our own day. The first problem was language. The second problem was the gradual disbursement of Lutherans throughout the country as they moved along on the expanding frontier. Once they found the Cumberland Gap and similar places that they could get over those mountains, they began to spread westward. They went to the west, which at that time meant West Pennsylvania, or maybe Ohio. The far west was Illinois, Michigan, maybe. But they were beginning to spread. And that geographical expansion resulted in a proliferation of Lutheran synods. So you went and settled in a new area, and then you had the synod of wherever you were. And along with that, you could hardly be considered, or so it seems, that they felt one could hardly be considered a legitimate synod unless one had your own hymn book. Then that was really proof that you had arrived. And so you began to have this proliferation of hymnals, some directed to be produced at the behest of various synods, and others individual efforts, like Paul Hinkle's two books. But so you had a proliferation of synods and an accompanying proliferation of hymnals. You'd be surprised how many official Lutheran hymnals there were over the period of time. The third problem was the overlapping influences of pietism, rationalism, and an amiable ecumenism. Each one of those presented its particular challenge. Pietism, while retaining a link with historic Lutheran hymnody, and Muhlenberg, I would call Lutheran Muhlenberg a confessional pietist. He certainly was from that period, and yet he retained a rather solid link with Orthodoxy. Pietism tended to emphasize the subjective character of human experience in contrast to the Orthodox confessionalism of the 16th century. Rationalism, on the other hand, worked to change the content of the hymnody in order to bring it into line with human reason. Changes that were usually most visible in hymnody dealing with the sacraments and the deity of Christ. An amiable and more relaxed ecumenism provided an environment in which the historic Lutheran hymnody often yielded to the hymnody of the surrounding denominations in America, a hymnody often characterized by a theology foreign to or at variance with understandings rooted in the Lutheran Reformation. Now, all of these forces tended to alter the character of Lutheran hymnody as well as the contents of its hymnals, turning the historic heritage of Lutheran hymnody into uncharted and, so the detractors of such a movement felt, frequently dangerous theological waters. Now, what one can do is to see in the various hymnals, and I'm just going to pull out a few of them to highlight how they reflected these. I mentioned Muhlenberg's 1786 Erbauliche Liedersammlung. It's interesting, a collection of devotional hymns for the building up of the Erbauliche Liedersammlung. Interesting to note the various titles of these and how the titles are often changing to reflect different emphases. That was 1786, the very first one. Probably the very first of these three forces that began to impinge upon Lutheran hymnody was that of rationalism. And probably the arch example of that was Frederick Quitman's A Collection of Hymns and a Liturgy of 1814, which was probably the most rationalistic Lutheran hymnal that we had ever seen. It's probably one of the two worst Lutheran hymnals that this country has ever produced. I'll get to the other. There's a tie for the other one. But anyway, now, you know, when I say that, please let's remember that Quitman did not sit down in his study one day and say, let's decide to destroy the faith by coming out with a rationalistic hymnal. He was reflecting what was going on in his time. And while it's very easy for us to look back and say, shame on you, Fred Quitman, for doing that, it's not so easy for us to see the same kinds of forces that are at work in our own day, which we may feel very strongly about, but 100, 200 years from now, they may look back at us and say, shame on us, or on some of us. Not on any of us here, of course. But Quitman's hymnal was a marvelous example of that. In his liturgies, you know, he was constantly talking about the great architect of the universe and stuff like that. That would be one good example of that. Rationalism was really, in America, in terms of hymnody, it was mostly evident in the English hymnody, because Quitman's hymnal was an English language hymnal. And it's characterized by the fact that it rather completely abandons the historic 16th century hymnody and opts instead for readily available English hymnody that was just handy to use. And at his time, that of course meant Watts and Wesley and others of that lesser figures from that tradition. And so one of the first things you see as Lutheran hymnals move into English, you see this great inflation in the number of hymns by Watts and Wesley. It was just there, ready to be used. So that's an interesting thing that was happening. There were other early English hymnals by Ralph Williston and others, but we need not concern ourselves about them. J.C. Kunze was also another one who put out an important English language hymnal, but we'll just skip over that now unless you're dying to ask something about J.C. Kunze's hymnal. But I think Quitman is a good example of a rationalistic Lutheran hymnal. If one talks about the effects of Unionism on the development of American Lutheran hymnody, there were all kinds of good reasons for this. At least in retrospect, we can say, yeah, that sort of made sense. We know that we're approaching the 300th, at that time, we're approaching the 300th anniversary of the Reformation in 1817. And Lutheran and Reformed, particularly the German immigrants of Lutheran and Reformed persuasion, would both be celebrating that event. And it's understandable that there would be conversations and plans in preparing for that. Aside from the fact that in Pennsylvania particularly, many Lutherans and many Reformed congregations shared a church building. Didn't mean that they necessarily worshiped together, but they used the building. One would use it at one time, then the others would come in the other time. And so then they would, when the Lutherans there, they bring in their Lutheran hymnals or whatever they had, and then they take them out, so then the Reformed would bring in their hymnals, and somebody got the bright idea, why couldn't we have one hymnal that would work for both of us and save us all that work? And so in 1817, on the 300th anniversary of the Reformation, there was published Das Gemeinschaftliche Gesangbuch, a hymnal for common use, for use in common by Lutheran and Reformed. And that was a really quite important book. It had as its specific purpose, according to its preface, to, quote, break down the wall of partition between Lutherans and Reformed, which is based only on prejudice, and to spread the true spirit of Jesus' religion, the spirit of tolerance and brotherhood, and to unite one Christian with another ever more fervently. Now, this was an extremely popular book. It had many printings. About the middle of the century, another Neues Gemeinschaftliches Gesangbuch was published. So it continued to be popular, and we know that it was used in places at least through the end of the century, or to almost the very end of the century. Common union churches were not infrequent, and common hymnals were popular and were well used. I'd just like to read two little comments on these common hymnal. One of the men who signed the preface was Gottlieb Schober of the North Carolina Synod, and he was all in favor of it, or he wouldn't have signed the preface, I guess. And he said, what he says about it is this: this meritorious undertaking paves the way to universal harmony, union, and love among our Lutheran and Reformed churches, removing all the obstacles which hitherto prevented that happy effect, and establishes a uniformity in that part of divine worship which cannot fail to be highly gratifying to all those who consider brotherly love an indispensable attribute of Christianity. So run right out and get one. That's what he was telling them. Some years later, on the other side of the equation, Socrates Henkel, who took a dimmer view of this, he said this about this book. He said, "No doubt this insidious course," that means the union of Lutheran Reformed, "produced, for the time being, the effect which the author of these lines, Schober, so much desired. But whilst it was doing this, it was aiding in engendering and cultivating a spirit which, as the child of an unjustifiable compromise of principles, ultimately resulted in injuring some of the most vital and fundamental doctrines and elements of the church, leaving her in that latitudinarian state of indifference and laxness in regard to almost everything that was regarded as positive and definite, in which she appeared about the beginning of the 19th century without helm or rudder, a deploring wreck requiring years for its restoration." He was not in favor of that. Now, if Quitman's book, A Collection of Hymns and the Liturgy, reflected the inroads of rationalism and common hymn books like this one, The Deleterious Effects of Unionism on American Lutheranism, it was the hymnals of the General Synod which clearly show the impact of the growing attraction of the new measures of frontier evangelism. The General Synod was formed in 1820. It was first promoted by people like J.H.C. Helmut and Gottlieb Schober. It was the only federation among Lutherans for 40 years, and really until the formation of the General Council in the 1860s. What the General Synod was an attempt to foster a greater Lutheran self-consciousness. It was to be a force, it was hoped, that would help prevent the absorption or submergence of Lutheranism in the sectarianism that characterized so much of American life, religious life. Yet from the very beginning, the General Synod was so broadly evangelical that it lost sight of some fundamental elements of Lutheranism. It was in the context of the General Synod that the mid-century conflict developed between the so-called American Lutheranism, advocated by Samuel Simon Schmucker, and a more confessional Lutheranism. American Lutheranism, does this sound familiar, was a movement which argued for adapting Lutheranism to the American scene to make it more agreeable and palatable in America. In the process, its opponents contended, it abandoned many beliefs and practices many held to be at the heart of the faith. Now, also at this time, in the 1820s and 30s, the Second Great Awakening was beginning to make its influence felt among Lutherans as they, among many others, appropriated the worship style, new measures, hymns, and songs of the revivalism that was sweeping the country. And the hymnal of the General Synod, which was published in 1828 and was called Hymns Selected and Original, was a good example of just that. One critic has said that Hymns Selected and Original was more selected than original, but nevertheless it did reflect the influence of the new frontier evangelism, the new measures, all of that. It clearly purposed, quote, "to embody the full scope of evangelical theology and every phase of evangelical experience." Rationalism, which had characterized Quitman's volume, was slowly receding before a rising wave of revivalism, and this new collection, quote, "was in full sympathy with the new methods, appropriating many rude revival songs," unquote. The fact that Schmucker's Hymns Selected and Original replaced a rationalistic collection with one, as Lewis Benson characterized it, one thoroughly impregnated with Calvinistic and Arminian material of highly subjective nature and a dogmatic scheme which practically ignored the church year, did not prevent it from enjoying widespread popularity. It incorporated sections on revivalism, temperance, hymns for a temperance meeting, and so on, together with some hymns dealing with the millennium, which was a popular theme of frontier revivalism. By 1849, it came out in 1828. By 1849, 21 years later, it had reached 56 editions or printings. It probably came the closest to being the common hymn book of the English-speaking Lutherans, being introduced into apparently no less than 4/5 of the congregations of the General Synod. In view of one Lutheran critic some years later, It was characterized by, quote, an agreeable mixture in varying proportions of Methodist and New School Presbyterianism relieved by a gentle tincture of our own faith. Okay, one of the things that is going on here in this business about rationalism and pietism and unionism and frontier revivalism, it comes down to how is it that our faith is validated? How do we validate our faith? Rationalism was saying essentially that our faith is validated if we can reason it out, if we can understand it intellectually, then that will validate it. Pietism, and then to a large extent as it degenerated into revivalism and so on, was an attempt to validate the faith through human experience. You know, if I feel it, then that validates it. And if I don't feel it, something is wrong. Against all that, of course, one Lutheran hymn writer from just a little bit earlier, but in full understanding of what was going on, he says, Ich glaub, was Gottes Wort verspricht, ich fühl es oder fühl es nicht. I believe and trust in the promises of God, whether I feel it or not. See, and that was the corrective to that. Okay, in the 1830s then and 40s and subsequent years, you began to see the beginnings now of a confessional revival in America. And I just want to skip over this a little bit, except to say the confessional revival in as it applied to hymnody was not, let us not forget that it was not just the result of the Prussian immigrants and the Saxon immigrants and the Bavarians and all those who came over firmly committed to this this new idea, but that it was also percolating among those spiritual descendants of Muhlenberg, although it was on simmer. It was slowly building, but it took a little longer there. But nevertheless, it was given a great impetus by groups like Grabau's group of Prussians, who ultimately formed the Buffalo Synod. And while Grabo and his group, they were the second ones. Grabo was, is that right? Grabo was they were the second to arrive. The Saxons arrived first, the Prussians arrived second, but the Prussians were the first one to publish a hymn book. In 1842, they published a book called Evangelisch-Lutherisches Kirchengesangbuch. Now notice, Kirchengesangbuch, that is, says something about the character of that book. Well, Grabo's book was a repristination of the Bapt's Gesangbuch to end all repristination. Here he is out in the woods in Buffalo with a small band of people, and then later in Wisconsin. And here he had this hymn book, which had, of course, German hymns, Latin hymns. The format of the book was taken right from the Bapt's Gesangbuch, in which you had collects and other liturgical materials scattered throughout the book, usually in the section of the church year to which they would pertain. And that was clearly his model, and he says as much in his preface. But he came, as did then Walther, who published the first hymnal of the Missouri Synod in 1847. We're in some anniversary of that now. 150, I guess it is, something like that. They came to this country, among other things, at least in terms of hymnody, firmly committed to a restoration of the 16th century hymnody. And that meant two things. It meant to return to the unaltered texts, which they felt had been irreverently, and not just irreverently, they had been altered and twisted out of shape by the succeeding waves of pietism, rationalism, and other forces. And now one way to go back to the spirit of the 16th century was to return to those unaltered texts. That was half of the story. The other half was that they were to return to the unaltered forms of the melodies, which meant the rhythmic forms of those chorales, which had become flattened out, even note, quarter note form. So they would be saying, A mighty fortress is our... Pretty dull. And they said, if we go back to, you know, so da da di da da di da da da, that would not only be a more true reflection of the spirit of those times, but it was also a vehicle to reinvigorate congregational singing. And you look back at the Lutheraner of that time, here you had the president of synod, vice presidents of synod, all writing articles in the Lutheraner extolling the virtues of the rhythmic chorale. That hardly happens today. I mean, in our time. It is so rare. And they were putting themselves on the line over against this dull and drab even note form of the melody. And of course, what was happening, you had those even note forms of the melody, and they were dull. I mean, they were dull. And so what one did is one sang, the idea was this was something that would move the heart. And so one sang them in, described in ways using words like reverently, with great dignity, and stuff like all meaning slow. And the idea was that the more slowly they were sung, the more impressive they would be. But they were still dull, musically speaking, they were dull. So musicians did what they always do, they try to fix that. So they did two things. First of all, they started to put passing tones in there. So then you got, a mighty fortress is our God. That made it a little more interesting. And then the second thing they did was to juice it up with real rich harmony underneath there. And then you had something that was a little more palatable, but the forms of the melodies were still those rather dull forms. And the best example of that, of course, are the chorales of Bach. Those are the pietistic forms of the even note chorales, then juiced up in the way that I've described. That was not Bach's concern. He simply took the melodies as he had them and applied his musical skills to them. But that was what was going on. So Grabau's book comes out in 1842. Walther's book comes out in 1847. And there were a few others. Those are two noteworthy ones. Among the spiritual descendants of Muhlenberg, in the English language, there came out in 1868 the Church Book, which was the Church Book of 1868, and then a number of years later, the Kirchenbuch of the. These were both books of the General Council. And both of those, all of those books, reflected this growing tendency to begin to return to the 16th century hymnody as an important source. For the most part, all these books that I've been talking about contained only texts. They did not contain music. The music was contained, number one, the people knew the melodies for the most part, or knew most of them, or many of them. And the music for the organist, if there was one, was contained then in chorale books, which were oblong, square format books. The very first one, one that was designed for Muhlenberg's hymnal, of 1786, which came out in 1813, was melody and figured bass. So if you played the organ, you had to know how to play figured bass and fill in the harmony. That was the first and only one of official American Lutheran hymnals that continued to follow that format, which was the standard format in Germany. But for these other books, other chorale books were developed. For Walther's hymnal, there was the chorale book of Heinrich Helter, who's from St. Louis ultimately, and Karl Brauer, who was a teacher at the Addison Teachers Seminary. And they came out in the 1880s, 1888, 1886, and 1888, I think were the years. The General Council's Church Book published the Church Book with Music, which is the only book, and that's now that they're beginning to look like hymnals like we're used to, like this size more or less, with the music in there, you know, for the four parts, and you can play right out of there. The Church Book with Music was the only Lutheran hymnal in this country that was edited by a woman, where the music edition was edited by a woman, and that was edited by Harriet Reynolds Crowth, later Harriet Reynolds Crowth Spaeth. And it was quite a marvelous book. Now, this is the 1860s we're talking about. What was going on elsewhere? Certainly the Oxford movement in England was taking hold, and the hymnological fruits of that were, among others, the translations of John Mason Neal of the Latin and Greek office hymns, the translations of Catherine Winkworth of many of the German chorales, many of those translations still in our hymnal, almost untouched. Touched a little bit. Hymnal editors always like to touch up everybody's works. Then they put ALT behind there. And then you never know who did that. See, you hide behind that. But anyway, all of this was going on. And so I think it would be fair to say then that during that time, there was this resurgence of interest from the 1830s, 40s on in a return in varying degrees among the various Lutheran bodies to a more more Lutheran in the sense of being rooted in the 16th century, at least, hymnody. That's only one gauge, but I think it's an important gauge. Now, I'd like to say a little bit then about one other movement yet, which was the basic movement of the 20th century. I talked about this proliferation of synods and proliferation of hymnals. The General Synod was kind of it was a federation, to draw some groups together, but they still maintained their identity. But by the end of the 1800s and then into the 1900s, what you begin to see is a movement toward consensus and consolidation among church bodies, church groups, and then also in hymnals. Probably the thing that first gave it impetus was the development of the Common Service, published in 1888. And that was so successful, practically all Lutherans picked up the Common Service in one form or another and rather immediately put it in their books. It was already in the hymnal of the General English Conference, which later ultimately became the English District. In 1889, it was already in their books just a few years after that. And other Lutherans followed. And they were so successful, they said, why don't we get together the three groups that did the Common Service, which were the General Synod, the General Council, and the United Synod of the South, which was an offshoot of the General Synod, because of slavery issues in the Civil War. They had produced the Common Service. And they said, that was nice. Now, why don't we also work on a hymnal together? Which they did, and was published in, surprise, surprise, in the year 1917, the 400th anniversary of the Reformation. And two things happened. One was the production of that hymnal, the Common Service book and hymnal, 1917, and in very short order, those three bodies had merged to form the United Lutheran Church in America. And that's the pattern you're going to see. Which came first, the chicken or the egg, is hard to say. But you see this coming together of groups working on a hymnal and then ultimately coming together in one body, or at least many of them. Which is first, which had the greater effect? I don't know, but they were going together. Let me just tick off a few examples. The Common Service Book and Hymnal was one, resulted in the formation of the United Lutheran Church, the old ULCA, United Lutheran Church in America. Not too many years after that, it was actually before that, in 1912, various Norwegian groups had been working on a variety of things, and they decided, they had all these different hymnals, there were umpteen little Norwegian groups. They all came together and they said, why don't we have one hymnal that would serve all of our Norwegian groups? And they did, and they produced the Lutheran Hymnary of 1913. Did I say 1912? It was 1913. The Lutheran Hymnary. Its editor was John Dolly, whose name you probably do not know, but the musical editor's name you do know, and that is F. Melius Christiansen. The Lutheran Hymnary of 1913. It didn't take long, but the three main churches cooperating in that merged then to form the Norwegian Lutheran Church of America, later known as the Evangelical Lutheran Church. The Lutheran Hymnary then becomes the official book of the Norwegian groups. Now, the Common Service Book and Hymnal, I've already mentioned that, but I would mention this, that if you remember your history, the basic supposition on which the Common Service was developed in terms of that liturgical formulations was the common consent of the pure Lutheran liturgies of the 16th century. In other words, they went back to that source, and the Common Service was, I think, is generally acknowledged a rather monumental achievement. When they got to work on the hymnal now, which would be the Common Service Book and hymnal, for one reason or another, they seem to have abandoned that principle in terms of an operating principle for the contents of the hymnal. And so I think I could argue that while you have a liturgical formulation in the Common Service, which is really quite exemplary and unheard of for its time, you have a hymnal which, while one would have to say many good things about it, from this specific angle of the content of 16th century Lutheran hymnody, left a great deal to be desired. Well, all right, so the Common Service Book and Hymnal. 1917. A few years later, I'll just kind of skip to the chase here, the three basic synods got together. There were a few others initially involved. The Iowa Synod, the Buffalo Synod, and the Ohio Synod got together and produced what was called in 1930 the American Lutheran Hymnal. And in that same year, those three groups also merged to form the American Lutheran Church. That's the old American Lutheran Church, two back there, whatever that was. American Lutheran Church. Now, it's in this same time when the various groups that we know in the Synodical Conference, when the Missouri Synod was contemplating revising its 1912 Evangelical Lutheran Hymnal, the Synod determined that they should proceed with this revision. This was in the 20s, late 20s and into the 30s, should proceed with this revision but invite all the other members of the Synodical Conference who wished to join together in the production of a joint book for the Synodical Conference. The result was the Lutheran Hymnal, 1941, which we have to remind ourselves is not a Missouri Synod book, it's a Synodical Conference book. And it was the result of this same kind of process. By the mid-century, or just past the mid-century, actually 1945, right before the mid-century, after the war, a number of other groups were coming together and were saying, maybe now we could have get together and produce a one book for some of these other disparate groups. And essentially, it was the United Lutheran Church in America, the American Lutheran Church, and then a whole bunch of smaller Scandinavian groups, which ultimately came together and produced in 1958 the Service Book and Hymnal. Luther Reed was the chief architect of that, as he had also had a significant hand in the Common Service Book and Hymnal of 1958, Luther Reed. The Missouri Synod was invited to participate in that book. Dr. Behnken, the president of the Synod at that time, said, thank you, but no thanks, we've just put out our hymnal, because the invitation was about 1945, and they just put out their hymnal in 1941, and they said it's too soon, and besides, we think many of our congregations haven't even started using this, our new one yet. It was, of course, well known that the Missouri Synod was not exactly in the forefront of ecumenical affairs at that time. And so it was understandable, but there was a legitimate reason also at the same time. So by the time you got to 1958, just past the mid-century, this proliferation of hymnals had come down to just two books, the Service Book and Hymnal, which served two-thirds of American Lutheranism, essentially the United Lutheran Church and the American Lutheran Church. They emerged in the early 60s, and the other third being served by the Lutheran Hymnal, which served the Synodical Conference and other groups that may use that. In 1965, at the Detroit Convention of the Missouri Synod, the Commission on Worship had been pursuing the unilateral revision of the Lutheran Hymnal, which was then over a quarter century old, well, almost a quarter century at that time. And at that time, at the Detroit Convention, the Synod took a different turn in which they said, no, stop the unilateral revision, instead invite all other Lutherans to join together in hopefully in the preparation of a common book which might serve all Lutherans. That was amazing, number one, in the general history of the Missouri Synod that they would do that. But it was also interesting that almost everybody that they invited accepted the invitation to do that. Especially, this was 65, especially since 1958, the Service Book and Hymnal, which had invited the Missouri Synod to participate, and they said, thanks, but no thanks. And it would be understandable if in 1965 the others would have said, you know, a plague on both your house, all your houses or whatever. We just did our own book. They said, no, let's join in. And so as a result of that was begun the Inter-Lutheran Commission on Worship. The result of that was the publication of the Lutheran Book of Worship in 1978. And then the upsets within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which resulted then in the publication of Lutheran Worship in 1982, which technically, according to synodical resolutions, was a revision of Lutheran Book of Worship. So that's when I refer to those two, I call it LBW/LW, because it was really kind of one large project which got disconnected. So while by mid-century there was hope that there might be one book, after this, by the early 1980s, there were still two books. In 1993, the Wisconsin Synod, which had been observing very carefully all these goings on from the late 50s, finally said, forget it, we're going to do our own hymnal. And they published in 1993, Christian Worship, a Lutheran hymnal. And that is a hymnal that is on the scene, and it deserves to be looked at. At least looking at the hymnody in it, it's a very significant book. And all of these books reflect this going back to the 16th century in terms of hymnody, not exclusively by any means, but they're building up that treasury of 16th and early 17th century hymnody, which had pretty much completely fallen out of use. But the story, and so now we had two, hopefully one, then we had two, then we had three. And the story isn't over yet, because next week, 9 days from now, on November 15th, the ELS, the Evangelical Lutheran Synod, the little Norwegian group, is publishing their hymnal, which will be called the Evangelical Lutheran Hymnary. And it's going to be a large book, I mean like 900 pages. And everybody is saying, we want to get our book on the table. We are all a player in this whole business here. But now it seems as if what was funneling down to one, hopefully now it's going the other way. So what to make of all that, and what will ultimately come of all that is difficult to say. Well, let me say just a couple of things in conclusion, and I'm way past what I said I was going to talk about, but that's all right. Is it so fascinating, isn't it? It is to me. Is there anything that we can learn about this when we look forward to sometime in the future when there will inevitably be another Lutheran hymnal or hymnals? Well, it seems to me, as I've looked all over all this, there are a few things that I would like to say. First, it's clear that the recovery of the Lutheran heritage of the chorale, especially the repertoire from its early years, has continued apace in every Lutheran hymnal of this century. That is simply the fact. You just need to look at the hymnals. Now, how congregations make use of the availability of that hymnody in the hymnal, that is another question. You can put it in the hymnal, but you can't force anybody to do it. And there, I think, what is the quote from Faust? You have this as heritage now. What you have as heritage, now take as task. In other words, we have been given this heritage. Now it is our task to use this and to help pass it on, and as a vehicle for gospel proclamation, for invigorating congregational singing in ways that is not always possible. But at least we can say the material is in the hymnals to an extent it has never been before. And that's good. Secondly, any objective view, meaning my view, that's an objective view, but I think particularly of the 20th century developments, any view of this ongoing parade of Lutheran hymn books from Muhlenberg's time to the present suggests to me, at least, that Lutherans have produced better and more useful hymnals when they have worked together in whatever groupings than when they have chosen to work alone. Certainly, I think every book from the 20th century demonstrates that fact. Thirdly, the success of the introduction and acceptance of a new hymnal seems to be determined, how well it's accepted by congregations, seems to be determined largely by the availability of the new material for comment and critique for a significant period of time before its publication, and the opportunity afforded the church for input and evaluation. That is almost the normal pattern for from Muhlenberg on. There was opportunity for input and evaluation in ways appropriate to the time. And I think as an example of that is true, the fact that Lutheran Book of Worship is used by some 95% plus of its congregations, it may be higher than that, that Christian Worship, a Lutheran hymnal, that's the Wisconsin Synod hymnal, only barely 3 years old, is in use in over 96% of Wisconsin Synod congregations, while Lutheran worship is used in only some 45 to 50% of Lutheran Church Missouri Synod congregations, clearly, to me at least, testifies to that fact. Now, there are all kinds of other considerations that help to explain that, but I think at the heart of many of these is the fact that people feel better about using hymnals when they know what's going to be in them and have had a chance to have their say. As anybody who's ever been involved in the production of a hymnal, and I was in one, and one is probably enough in a lifetime, you know that the most important day in the whole process is when the committee finally publishes the list of what hymns are going to be in there. And then you run for cover. because everybody immediately looks to see if their favorites are in there, and if not, why not? And that's always an interesting moment. And so I can remember it was true with the Lutheran Book of Worship and also Lutheran Worship. You know, something was of their favorite from the Lutheran hymnal was not in there. And by George, they let the appropriate people know, you're taking away all our good Lutheran hymns, like those by Watts and Wesley and so on and so forth. I made the point. Perhaps it's time, I just throw this out, to revive an idea as one looks to the future, an idea which has surfaced several times in American hymnal history in the past and never got very far, which was the idea that could Lutherans, all Lutherans, or a significant body of Lutherans somehow agree on a common core of hymns to which they could all say, well, we all want those in our hymnal. And then for various groups that have particular needs, publish an addendum or an anhang of some kind or other, which would then have those, so that the Norwegians want certain things they want and nobody else wants, they would have opportunity to do that. And then we'd have one book which would be called the same thing that everybody would use, but you'd have a Missouri Synod version with their particular ones they like, but we'd share a common core. That idea has surfaced at least twice in American Lutheran history, once with the Norwegians and once in the Missouri Synod, never got very far. Finally, let me just say this and then throw this open. The desire to produce a new hymnal by any Lutheran group is to some extent motivated by a varying mixture of motives. First, perhaps a genuine desire, not perhaps, a genuine desire to serve its constituency amidst the changing cultural situations in which the church finds itself. Also the desire to maintain a particular theological posture also in the song of the church. And then perhaps thirdly, the less commendable motivation of the pride of maintaining a particular and separate institutional identity, and the hymnal becomes the vehicle through that. Now these varying notions, every one of those has played roles in the development of American Lutheran hymn books in the past, and they, I think, undoubtedly will continue to play a role in the future. Now, just how these factors will continue to shape the hymnals of American Lutheranism will be determined by the theological vision, the political astuteness, and the level of churchmanship of the leaders of the Lutheran church bodies in America. And we shall see what shall be happening in the years ahead. Let me stop there. And if you have comments or questions or criticisms, especially praiseworthy comments, those are always any comments or something that you'd like to talk about in relation to this topic that we didn't talk about? Yes.
As we're beginning to look to a new hymnal, you've repeatedly mentioned the core of Lutheran Reformation hymns, and certainly if 400 or 500 years ago they had an important valid message, that message is no less important today. However, also being a noted composer of our time, you surely acknowledge the importance of having current and modern hymns, but
yeah, well, I think your first criterion has to be theological. You look at the contents of the text. Does this text say what we're about when we come together and use Christian song? And the purpose of Christian song in corporate worship is not, first of all, or if at all, to make us feel good about that, but it's in terms, I would argue, in terms of proclamation and praise. You know, are we proclaiming the gospel in an appropriate way through this vehicle. And that's a textual matter, obviously, but I think it's also a musical matter. In other words, does the music that we use to project that text, does that meet the same standards of integrity and craftsmanship and, theological integrity? Is that also to be found in the music that we are using in this vehicle? And I think that's important. Yeah, I think, yes, I'm not trying to downgrade the importance of the fact that every age adds to the treasury of the church's song its own unique things. Thank you. You mentioned I've written some hymns. That's true. But I think the worst thing you can do is to say, I'm going to sit down and write a hymn for posterity. It doesn't work that way, or at least it doesn't work that way with me. I think every hymnal editor or committee feels very strongly the impetus to say, we want to add something of our own time, the best of our own song of this age or this generation. And that's laudable, and I think it's commendable. But it's going to take a generation or two or three to sift that out and to see whether what we think was the best of our generation is really worthwhile hanging on beyond that. And that's always the difficulty. The hymns, I can remember three hymns that in the 1960s, early 70s, we thought these are God's gifts that will never, at least the general consensus, was that these are gifts of song which will be singing to La Parousia. And those were, "They'll Know We Are Christians by Our Love," "Alleluia," and "Sons of God." And everybody could sing them out. Now, you don't hear them at all. They're not in the books for a variety of reasons, some musical, some textual. They've just, for all intents and purposes, fallen out of use. And on that short term, they've fallen out of use. And so we can be very enthused about a hymn that was written yesterday. We say, whoa, this is the best thing since sliced bread. And we may have a different view later on. But it takes sifting. Yes?
Could you speak to why it seems psalms are not used very often for hymn texts? And perhaps even a corollary to that, can we make the psalms singable in any way, shape, or form?
Yes. Oh, well, yes. Yeah. There are two. Well, yes, yeah, sure. Number one, you have the whole body of metrical psalmody. In other words, now, so when you sing, for example, a metrical psalm, you sing, "The Lord's My Shepherd, I'll Not Want," for example, I think we have to help people see that what they are singing is not a hymn which, oh, by the way, happens to have the content of the 23rd Psalm. It's not a hymn, but it's sort of a psalm. It is the 23rd Psalm in the guise of a hymn. You see the difference? So that when we sing that, we say, ah, we are singing the 23rd Psalm. Or we're singing the 90th Psalm, or whatever it is, metrical psalm. So I think that's one thing. And sometimes, perhaps, if we would put them together in sections so that they would, or that they would at least be identified as metrical psalms, that might help us. But the other thing, of course, is the singing of the prose text of the psalm, which is one of the standard contributions of all Lutheran Book of Worship, Lutheran Worship, Christian Worship, a Lutheran hymnal, and we'll see what the Evangelical Lutheran Hymnary does. But the restoration of singing prose psalm texts is what, that's where it's at in hymnody, or in congregational singing these days. And so everybody's trying to think up ingenious ways to do that. And the simple psalm tones that are in the books, just sung unaccompanied, if you're in an acoustical environment that is at all favorable, is really quite a marvelous experience. Our congregation sang them for 2 years before they even knew there were accompaniments, because we just never used them. And they got used to singing them, and they sang them better without than with. But I don't know if that's, I think those resources are there. Somebody else, yes, sir. Well, if I knew the answer to that, we'd all be rich. It certainly hasn't improved with that. I don't think that's not a a real hopeful sign for that to happen. But I don't want to say that it couldn't. If you take, for example, I think the two areas where, if you say, how do you go about building up a core of hymns in common? The two places where Lutherans at least can zero in on are, one, the hymn of the day, which we all share in, there are some differences, but I mean, there is a large degree of commonality among the various hymn of the day lists. And then the other area is the church year hymns. Now, if you take the hymns of the day for Advent, what are they? Savior of the nations, come. On Jordan's bank, the Baptists cry, O come, Emmanuel. At least those three come to my mind. I don't know of a hymnal where those aren't in, you know. And I think if you take the first 25 hymns in Lutheran worship and look to see how many of those are in other Lutheran hymnals, other hymnals, the Episcopal hymnal, whatever, you'd be amazed at the amount of congruence between those. You know, they're not all going to be the same, but you know, we all sing holy, 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 now thank we all our God. Even Roman Catholics sing a mighty fortress is our God. I mean, there's a lot of congruence between those. Now, I'm not suggesting this, but I know that at least one prominent Lutheran theologian has said that the next Lutheran hymnal, now he was not speaking within the Missouri Synod, should not be a Lutheran hymnal, meaning it shouldn't have the name Lutheran on there, but it should be a book which could be shared in common by many people of many backgrounds. I'm not quite ready to say that. But what he was testifying to is the fact that we do hold in common many, many hymns, which are just a common property of American Christians. We have unique things that we want to add. I'm not real hopeful that it'll happen in the same way, but who would have guessed in 1964 that in a year later the Missouri Synod would say, let's turn around and invite everybody to make a hymnal? You know, I think somebody would have turned over in his grave. But it happened, and then it almost did happen. So I don't know. God works in mysterious ways. Yes, sir. Yes, I think that's a very sad state of affairs, because what results from that is we are losing a common core of hymnody of whatever kind, and we're at the mercy of whoever picks those hymns, because we can't even now look in a book at ones that aren't chosen and maybe meditate on those or whatever. I think that would be sad. This summer, the MENC, Music Educators National Conference, came out with a list of 40 songs that they said every American child should be learning in school. You know, everything from Amazing Grace to America the Beautiful to Kumbaya to whatever. These are not necessarily religious songs. And the point was that in the public schools, many of the religious songs, of course, are being excluded for all matters of separation of church and state and however that plays out, and the fact that music programs in public schools are very often non-existent, and children are not even learning what we kind of all assume everybody knows. A lady who is a choir director with a children's choir in the northern Chicago suburb says her children in her choir at Advent and Christmas, she can't even assume they know Silent Night. Hark the Herald Angels Sing. They don't know them. You know, and you go back 30, 40 years when you sat around the piano and you had the Golden Book of Favorite Songs, and you learned a kind of a core of songs that kind of everybody knew. And when all else failed, you knew the national anthem, and you could go to the ball game and sing. Now you go and watch somebody give their rendition of it, which is so musically confused that it precludes anybody trying to sing along. You know, you hear somebody's version of that. See, you couldn't possibly sing along. But I think that's kind of what's happening, and that's happening in church. I think that's one of the contributing factors. My candidate for the Keen Grasp of the Obvious Award for this year was in a publication from Prince of Peace Burnsville, where the director of music had determined after 25 years of projecting texts on the wall, you know, from a screen, that he decided that after 25 years they have learned that it's more helpful to people if they put the melody there too. I think, duh, you know, I mean, well, you know, and the next thing, they'll want to put those all together in a book. Yeah. Well, let me just say this. In the 1970s, in the work of the Inter-Lutheran Commission on Worship, there was a strong movement at that time to move away from a hardback book which had all the stuff in there. That was kind of the original tense, sort of. And then they said, well, now we're living in different times and so on. And so the emphasis was on materials, disposable materials, booklets and pamphlets, and so on. And then, you know, what resulted, you had all these pamphlets, and you're shuffling all the sheets and pamphlets and this and that. And the greatest example was there was one book, you're singing, holding this book, and at one point, you had a clap. And we couldn't figure out how to do it. And then you catch it and do it. Yeah. So somebody got the idea, why don't we take the best of all this stuff and put this in one book? You know, again, keen grasp of the obvious. So I think I kind of don't think that the day of the book, one book, is gone. It's under attack in some places, but I think, you know, it's a device not only for singing; it's a device for catechesis, for all kinds of other things, and I think we'll really lose that vehicle if we don't have it. Somebody's going to tell me when it's time to be quiet. Yes. Oh, those are the easy questions. And I don't know about the ramifications of Missouri Synod congregations adopting Christian worship. I know there are, I think two that I know of that have adopted it. I would say this, that there, in terms of this 16th century core, however one is going to define that, both books are very strong. I mean, there are differences. I think that probably Christian worship made a more concerted effort to have more new things or more recent things in their book, I think. That's kind of a tentative, I mean, I've gone through it, and it's kind of a tentative conclusion. But I think there was that emphasis there. They were at a time when they could take advantage of the experience of both LBW and LW, to know what best to do and maybe what not to do in some cases. And so I think they tried to capitalize on that. As to, if you mean the appropriateness of a Missouri Synod congregation using that, I don't have any, well, I have an opinion, but I'm going to stay out of those waters. In the same way that you have Missouri Synod congregations using the Lutheran hymnal, Lutheran Book of Worship, Lutheran worship, and in a sense, they're all legitimately using them. Now, you may want to argue about that, but anyway, I think according to the law, that's possible. So I don't know. Yes, sir. I think it would be fair to say that, as far as I know, there is no current movement in the ELCA to come out with a major revision of Lutheran Book of Worship. The publication of the supplement with one voice was, I think, it was. It's probably helpful to many of their congregations, but it was also, I think, in my own cynical view, a kind of a tactical move, although that wasn't its prime objective, I don't think. A move which helped to stave off immediate agitation for a new hymnal. The groups that always agitate for a new hymnal in any anybody are the ones who have particular causes to espouse. And in the current causes nowadays among Lutherans in varying degrees are multicultural concerns, language, gender language concerns. And many of those, I think, in the ELCA have been kind of not held at bay, but I mean, they've kind of been satisfied with what is in With One Voice. And so it's kind of pushed back a little bit the date. That's my own evaluation of that. But as far as I know, there's no movement at the moment to do anything there. As I mentioned in the LBWLW, I look at that as one, that's one process with kind of two results. You noted that they are in many ways very much alike. Those who would appraise them, would praise them, will point to the great similarities. Those who would have a more derogatory view will point to the differences and say those differences are absolutely crucial. And you can argue or discuss that matter. But what happened was in the synodical resolution was that the Lutheran Book of Worship was to be was presented for adoption, and the motion was then, do we adopt this? Do we adopt it with revisions? Do we say the heck with the whole thing and start over and make one all our own? And those are the three options, and the middle one was chosen. There's a lot more to that story, which we can go into privately if you like. But it seems to me that that was kind of what was happening. And so you have two books which are very much alike. I would think this much you can say very objectively, that the two books which preceded them, Service Book and Hymnal and the Lutheran Hymnal, and then you compare Lutheran Book of Worship and Lutheran Worship. Lutheran Book of Worship and Lutheran Worship are much more alike in their content and general tone and the thrust of those books than were the other two. The other two are much farther apart in a variety of ways, liturgical and hymnological and all kinds of ways. And so in a sense you could say, well, that's a step toward some closer meeting. At least I would evaluate it that way. But what the future will bring, who knows what that is. Yes, sir?
Two questions. The first one, Kirk asked a question about how are hymns selected for inclusion, and you gave kind of a dual answer. First, the text is looked at, and I can understand that. I know how to read and compare. But you also said the music is looked at. Not being a musician, how do you evaluate music? That's the first question. The second one had to do with Lutheran worship, and it seems that in Lutheran worship,
Yes. Well, I can tell. Well, answer the second part first, because that's the easiest part. Yes, in both LBW and LW, many of the hymns are not intended to be sung in four parts, which you could do with the Lutheran hymnal if you had to make a few adjustments, but you could kind of do it that way if you wanted to. The reason for that is, number one, many hymns were never intended to be sung in parts. Take, for example, Vaughan Williams' For All the Saints, except for a couple stanzas where he specifically wrote a harmonization for choir. But that's another matter. In general, that's a unison tune. In general, the great tunes of the Lutheran heritage of the 16th and early 17th century were written to be sung in unison, unaccompanied, not with accompaniment. And so in those cases, the settings were fashioned in a way not to encourage that. Or at least not necessarily make that possible. In contrast to a hymn like Abide With Me, Fast Falls Eventide, if when you hear that hymn played, there's certain harmony you want to hear because you know that's the way that goes. And if the organist plays something else weird, you immediately know, no, that's not the way it's supposed to go because you think of that tune with the harmony that goes with it. That is not true of A Mighty Fortress or Es ist gewisslich an der Zeit or any of those. So that's that question. The process, I can tell you the process for the Lutheran Book of Worship, and I think it was essentially the same process. As far as hymns were concerned, there was a hymn music committee and a hymn text committee. People who wanted to suggest hymns. The texts went first to the text committee. They presumably screened them, and they would send them on to us and say, I was on the hymn music committee, and they would say, here are texts that need to be provided with music. And then the music committee would provide a tune or select a tune. In many cases, it was obvious what tune you were going to use because there was one associated with it, and provide an accompaniment harmonization if possible. In many instances, the music committee would send the text back to the text committee and say, what were you guys thinking of? This text is awful, or it's heretical, or something that we had. And there was that give and take. And sometimes they would say the same about our music selections. But out of all of that, anyway, came what the result was. I think the theological, that's where you start with theology, with the theology of the text. And every book, I don't think there is any book that you can say is really perfect. The only hymnal that will be perfectly suited to my wishes, it will be one that I make up. And for you, it'll be one you make up. But now you try to prepare a book to serve a wide variety of pieces, people with wide variety of styles of piety. That is a monumental job. And so you don't start by saying, well, these folks will like this one and these folks will like... You start with liturgical considerations. What do we need for the celebration of the liturgy? And that's where you start.
Thank you,
Okay. Yeah.
Dr. Schultz, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.